The uprising in Baltimore began on Saturday, April 6th. By Thursday the next week, cleanup had begun in the city, but during the riots, the violence spread over 1,000 city blocks. It took the police, the National Guard, and federal troops, as well as the tireless efforts of community leaders to end the violence. During the rioting, 6 people died, 700 were wounded, and almost 1,000 businesses were burned, looted, or vandalized. In part 4 of our series, 68, The Fire Last Time, WYPR looks at the aftermath of the upheaval. Suni Khalid picks up the story on the afternoon of Thursday, April 11, 1968.
Fires were still smoldering when Mayor Tommy DeLisandro learned that Governor Spiro Agnew planned a tongue-lashing for Baltimore's black leaders.
I got advance notice of his statement from one of the TV stations, and I read it before it became public, and I called him. And I said, Governor, can you either not make the statement or redo the statement or not call for a declaration of war with the black community? Smoke is still present in the city. Let's just have a cooling off period. But he said, Tommy, that's how I feel, and I'm going to say it, and I'm going to stick by my statement.
Agnew had invited about 100 of Baltimore's black leaders to a meeting at his Baltimore office. Agnew released a transcript of his remarks to the press ahead of time. Morgan State professor Homer Favor, worrying that he was late for the meeting, turned on his car radio and heard a reporter quoting the governor's prepared statement.
I did not request your presence to bid for peace with the public dollar.
When Favor arrived at the meeting, he spotted several friends, including Perrin Mitchell, the head of Baltimore's anti-poverty agency, the Reverend Miriam Bascom, and State Senator Verda Welcome.
Wait, this is a trap. This is a trap. I called Perrin aside. And Miriam, I said, it's a setup. And I explained to them that they'd already given them the news clip as to he's going to cuss us out. And the cameras were up there rolling. So Verda Welcome says, no, no, we don't. I said, no, let's leave. Let's leave. She said, no, no, let's stay in here.
That's the only reason we
stay.
But when white leaders complimented you for your objective, courageous action, you immediately encountered a storm of censure from the Negro community.
The speech was laced with the kind of rhetoric Agnew would become known for. At first, he made a distinction between the leaders in front of him and black militants like Stokely Carmichael, who had visited Baltimore 3 days before the riots. Agnew referred to them as circuit riding, caterwauling, riot inciting, burn down America types. But then Governor Agnew castigated those assembled for failing to stop the violence. He accused the leaders, many of whom had been on the streets appealing for calm, of cowardice. Agnew said they were afraid of being called Uncle Toms.
The criticism was born of a perverted concept of race loyalty, and inflamed by the type leader I mentioned earlier is not here today. And you ran.
Most of Agnew's audience simply walked out before the governor was finished. Many were stunned, since he'd had a reputation as a liberal Republican. The governor supported open housing legislation, for instance, and school desegregation. But Agnew's vitriol that day didn't surprise the Reverend Miriam Bascom. 5 years earlier, Bascom had been involved in demonstrations aimed at desegregating Gwin Oaks Amusement Park when Agnew was the Baltimore County executive. When the two met face-to-face some time later, Agnew told Bascom,
"Every time I see you, I'm repulsed by you."
Bascom had a simple reply.
"That's a problem you'll have to overcome."
By most accounts, Spiro Agnew was a moderate liberal in his social views. In fact, he was elected as Maryland's governor 2 years earlier, essentially on the strength of his support in mostly black communities in Baltimore City and Prince George's County. But any kind of civil disorder was deeply offensive to him. The mob, he believed, could never be allowed to dictate to society. Agnew was right about one thing, though. Baltimore's black leaders were agonizingly conflicted about the looting and burning. They knew it was damaging to the black community, and they tried to stop it. But they sympathized with the anger and despair. Homer Favor remembers a call afterward from his friend Jim Rouse, the developer of Columbia.
"If I showed you a picture of one of your cohorts, compatriots, torching a building, Would you believe it? Would you do anything about it? And I didn't know what to say to him. I respected him. I loved him. So finally it occurred to me. I said, Jim, I'm sorry you asked me that. I said, because I feel unclean because I didn't burn down a building. These people were protesting the brutal treatment that we got, and I did not participate in it.
If Dr. King's death and riot weren't devastating enough, black leaders in Baltimore saw the man who had berated them rising in the political firmament during the unrest. Agnew's tough law and order stance during the riot had brought him to the attention of National Republican Party leaders and Richard Nixon, the GOP presidential nominee that year.
Agnew wasn't really on Nixon's radar before the uprising.
Peter Levy teaches history at York College in Pennsylvania and is the author of Civil War on Ray Street, an account of the racial unrest in Cambridge, Maryland.
Agnew gives this presentation to black leaders in Baltimore, and there's wide reporting on it, and thousands of letters actually pour into Agnew's office, 80-90% very positive. He had distinguished himself by becoming a voice, I think, of white backlash.
It was the beginning of the GOP's Southern strategy, aligning the party with political conservatives, many of whom had strongly opposed racial desegregation. Former Governor Marvin Mandel was the Speaker of the House in 1968 and remembers how the selection happened.
Nixon had made an arrangement with Strom Thurmond that Strom Thurmond could veto any vice presidential candidate. So he had vetoed two or three. And then Louise Gore, who was Senator Gore from Montgomery County, said, "What about Agnew?" And Strom Thurmond said, "Who's Agnew?" And she told him he's the governor of Maryland and told him what had happened. He said, "Well, it sounds all right with me." And she went, took Agnew to Nixon, and Nixon said, "Well, if it's all right with Strom Thurmond, it's all right with me."
That summer, months after the unrest, Agnew became Richard Nixon's vice presidential running mate. Agnew called D'Alessandro to tell him the news.
I didn't know when I hung up the phone that that was the end of my career.
D'Alessandro decided his political aspirations to be the next governor were over because Agnew's midterm departure meant Marvin Mandel, the House Speaker, would succeed him in Annapolis.
If I was going to run now, instead of running against a Republican incumbent, I would have to run against a Democratic incumbent.
So Agnew, the law and order Republican, moved up, and the progressive Democrat, D'Alessandro, was out. Before leaving office, Governor Agnew initiated recovery efforts. He planned a new agency that would help rebuild the areas that burned. Most of these were never realized, although profound changes were in store for Baltimore and the nation, particularly for black Americans.
The crime that we see today is a direct result of Richard Nixon's policies.
Billy Murphy is a former Baltimore City Circuit Court judge and a longtime criminal defense attorney. He says the riots helped trigger the law and order backlash of the 70s and 80s and a national criminal justice policy that helped put thousands of black men behind bars.
I mean, the numbers boggle the mind. In Baltimore, for example, 75% of all black men who reside in Baltimore either in jail or on parole or probation.
Murphy and many others also believe that the law and order policies of the 70s and 80s had a devastating impact on black families.
When I was growing up, most black families were functional. Even the single-parent families were functional because the men weren't in jail. They were able to work. They were able to provide support. They were able to see their children. They were able to participate in the rearing of their children.
Since 1968, thousands of black families in inner-city Baltimore have suffered serious setbacks. In the 1970s, Baltimore's industrial base began to collapse. The massive steel plants, shipyards, and auto plants, where many black Baltimoreans had gotten good jobs, closed, ending many families' climb into the middle class. In 1968, the national unemployment rate for African Americans of both sexes was 3.6%. 40 years later, that rate has more than doubled to 8.3%. As the unemployment rate climbed, drug trafficking and drug addiction helped fill the vacuum. The 1970s and 80s saw waves of drug epidemics nationally. In Baltimore, heroin and crack cocaine fueled an explosion in violent crimes, especially homicide.
All of this related to drugs. The jails were full of youngsters related to drugs.
Homer Favor says he and his longtime friend, Miriam Bascom, despair over the impact drugs have had on young people in the city's poorest neighborhoods.
Kids kills a kid out here on the corner of the night. I find it abhorrent. So does Miriam. He has to bury him. But I can't curse those kids because they were put on that corner by public policy. Their daddies worked at Sparrows Point, Martin Marietta, Armco Steel, Crown Cork and Seal. Where are those jobs now?
Still, the urban unrest of 1968 brought some positive changes. Michael Olesker, who was reporting for the Baltimore News American back then, remembers that community organizers had gained a new and persuasive argument. Some 2 years after the riots, he was reporting on a group of people who were trying to get a drug treatment program in Cherry Hill.
They got inside a board meeting one day of all of these state health officials. And I walked in, and here were all these street guys, you know, with pretty angry looks on their faces and, you know, dressed up in street outfits, you know, sunglasses and sneakers untied. And, you know, I mean, guys with street nicknames like Butch and Pissy and, I mean, smart guys, but, you know, had turned to heroin in a sense of desperation and now wanted to get off. And these health officials said to them, you know, we'd love to help you, but we just don't have the money. And I remember this guy who they called Nose, and he said, well, you know what? We're going to find out how much money you've got when we burn down that Cherry Hill shopping center and you come up with money for a study on why we burned down that shopping center. And I remember a health official saying, you know, we do have that supplementary fund.
The riots brought change that sifted through government and society. Fairly soon after the riots, the number of black city officials began to increase.
I couldn't have been a commissioner in 68.
Former Baltimore Police Commissioner Bishop Robinson.
I think we took advantage of opportunities and moved up through the ranks in the various departments, not only police, fire department, and other government agencies. People began to see that, you know, there's talent everywhere.
In 1971, William Donald Schaefer succeeded Tommy DeLisandro as mayor. Bishop Robinson said Schaefer began to look for and groom young black leaders, including Robinson.
He said, you need to sharpen your administrative skills. And I did. And I began to hone my skills in administration and budget.
When Schaefer became governor, he took Robinson with him to Annapolis as Secretary of Corrections. Increased black voting power after 68 could make or break a candidate. Elected officials realized they needed to involve black people in every aspect of public life or suffer the consequences. Today, Baltimore's top four elected officials, including mayor, city council president, comptroller, and city state's attorney, are black. 40 years after the fires of 1968, longtime Baltimoreans have different views about the impact of the riots. Writer Gil Sandler, who lives in Roland Park, says before 68, civil rights gains like school desegregation were already happening.
2 years before Brown versus Board of Education, Polytechnic began to accept African-American student. 2 years before Brown versus Board of Education.
But after 68, Sandler says blacks and whites moved farther apart.
Well, we went into a deep funk. There's no question about it. And it triggered white flight. There's no question about that. Many were discouraged. At some point, there was, and among many, there was a kind of choosing up of sides. And it took a long time for the city to make sense of it all.
For Antonia Keene, the unrest in April 1968 was quickly channeled into greater civic activism in many city neighborhoods, but at a cost.
There was a lot of white flight you know, and there was no two ways about that. And remember also, you know, the measure of how well you've done is to get out of your old neighborhood and your little row house and, you know, to live in a little plot of grass, you know, in the suburbs. You know, and I still have people that, you know, I knew from high school, and they'll say to me, "You still live in the city?" As if I'm a failure. You know? And it, I mean, it, to me, it's always kind of amusing because that became, you know, kind of one of the things that you could do, right? Get out. And that happened. And of course, that then created lots of problems with vacant housing, absentee landlords, you know, and kind of exacerbated all the kinds of things that were going on.
Baltimore's black leaders understood the frustrations that led to the riots, but were deeply worried by the violence they unleashed. Reverend Miriam Bascom is just as worried 40 years later.
You asked me how I felt. I felt hopeless. You asked me how I feel today. And though there are those who have made it, I still have a sense of hopelessness and helplessness, because until the nation decides to act grown up and to put its energies on educating and housing, we can expect this to happen again.
40 years ago today, on the eve of his assassination, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his final speech in Memphis. Alluding to the threats against his life, the civil rights leader struck a confident tone about America's struggle for racial equality.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Dr. King might, with a measure of wonder, acknowledge the progress he and his movement achieved, but he might also renew his call for Americans, black and white, to proceed against poverty and violence and lingering discrimination with the fierce urgency of now. I'm Suni Khalid for WIPR.
WIPR's special series, 68, The Fire Last Time, was made possible in part by a grant from the Maryland Humanities Council. The producers are Suni Khalid, Mary Rose Madden, and Fraser Smith, with help from Jonathan Ahrens and Lisa Morgan. The executive producer is Deborah George. Special thanks to the University of Baltimore and their project, Baltimore 68, Riots and Rebirth. We'll be right back.